In the latest in our podcast series, the IBA talks to David Anderson, the UK's independent reviewer of terrorism legislation. Here he speaks about the robustness of counter-terrorism laws in Europe following the recent attacks in Brussels and what effect a UK exit from the European Union might have on the security situation. We also discuss his views on the UK government's anti-radicalisation strategy, PREVENT, and the latest draft of the controversial Investigatory Powers Bill.
Obviously, in light of recent events, we have the events in Brussels and in Paris and in Turkey as well. Has this changed anything or put further pressure on the UK government to improve anti-terrorism legislation in the UK? Or do you think that it's already fit for purpose?
There's always pressure to tighten up laws. And I think it's a great tribute to this country that in the 5 years after 2010, we've actually seen both an increasing threat but also less severe laws governing counter-terrorism. Experience has taught us the bits that are really useful, the bits that are not so useful. So we've seen, for example, no suspicion stop and search under the Terrorism Act being removed. 1 million people were stopped under that power in the 10 years after 9/11. Nobody has been stopped under it since 2011. I think the important thing when these atrocities happen is to keep your head. Remember that what the terrorists want is an overreaction, and that the best laws in the long run are those which are not only effective but seem to be fair.
You basically said that the fight against terrorism could be hampered if the UK were to leave the EU. I thought that was a really interesting point. Maybe you can outline just sort of briefly why you think this is the case.
Europe is gradually getting its act together on national security and terrorism. It's a slow business. We're by no means there yet. But some really useful things are coming along. Databases whereby police forces can share information they have on subjects of interest. Rules, for example, requiring airlines to provide in advance the details of the people on their flights so that you know who to look out for when they land. And people say, well, couldn't the UK just be a part of these things even if it was outside the EU? To which the answer is, well, probably, but it wouldn't necessarily be easy. For a start, the other member states would want to be assured that our standards of privacy protection were as strong as the standards they had within Europe. But even if we could be part of it, we could in future only be part of what the others negotiate. And one thing about British involvement over the last 10 years or so is that we've actually been in the forefront. We've been the leaders, rather unusually, in Europe in developing the policies to deal with counter-terrorism and information exchange and so on. So we would have to take what we could get as associate members, as opposed to the current position where we're actually making the policy and pushing the laws through.
And there's been quite a lot of criticism in the press after Paris has happened as well, and now it's happened with Brussels in relation to their police and counter-terrorism legislation in those countries. Do you think that there's something that they can learn from the UK and how we've dealt with 7/7 and other incidents?
Yes, but we can't be complacent. In France, they had no terrorist atrocities between 1996 and 2012. And if we'd been talking then, you would probably have been saying, shouldn't we be learning from the French? So these things do go in cycles. But I think there are two things we do particularly well in this country. The first thing is that we integrate different forms of intelligence very well. So that includes human intelligence, technical intercept and so on, and also the analysis of bulk data. And the other thing we do really well, and it seems to be a very difficult thing to imitate, is that we have excellent relations between intelligence and police. Mm-hmm. They work very well together, and that very often isn't the case in other countries. There is fragmentation of different intelligence bodies. You saw, for example, the 9/11 Commission in the US pointed that out as one of the reasons why nobody knew what was going on. There weren't people to piece together the various bits of the mosaic that were possessed by different agencies.
You mentioned bulk data, which made me automatically think of the Investigatory Powers Bill, which I know has obviously been very forefront in your mind. In terms of the latest revision, do you think that it effectively addresses gaps in our surveillance whilst also upholding the rule of law?
It only produces one new power. That's quite a controversial power to require service providers to store records of people's internet activity. The much more important thing that the Act does is avow the powers that exist. And in this respect, it's almost unique in the world. I mean, all the powers to which the government aspires or which it already uses are set out there in black and white. So Parliament can debate whether they are a good idea or not. And the other thing it does is it greatly increases the safeguards, both for the authorization of very intrusive powers, but also for the oversight of how the intelligence agencies and the police use those powers. So it gets the big things right. There's plenty to quarrel with in the bill, but I welcome it.
You've also spoken out about the need, perhaps, for an independent review of the government's anti-radicalisation strategy, PREVENT. And maybe you can tell me a bit about why you feel so strongly about this.
Well, although I'm an independent reviewer, I'm not an uncritical fan of independent review, but I do think that is a good way to proceed when you have a policy whose operation is secret and yet which has the capacity really to impinge on people's human rights. That's why we have independent review of the counter-terrorism laws, as do the Australians, and I think there are other countries that are looking at it as well. That's also why I think we need independent review of the PREVENT programme. It's supposed to be the soft end. It's helping us all live harmoniously together, making sure that people can spot signs of radicalisation at an early age. But partly because it is so secret and so untransparent, it is provoking quite a bad reaction in some communities. Mm-hmm. There are all sorts of rumours and suspicions about how the policy is being operated. Some of them, I'm quite sure, are unfounded. Some of them may be founded. How do we know?
Are there any other big issues that you're seeing at the moment, either in light of events that are happening or anything that you feel that in our legislation needs to be improved or reinforced?
The sweet spot is always shifting in terms of the right balance between security and liberty. My sense is that with counter-terrorism law, it's not in a bad place at the moment. We do have very strong laws in this country, but we've got a lot of experience with them too, and they've been very aggressively tested by the courts. Everything that happens here is taken to court. Very often it ends up in the Supreme Court or in Strasbourg. And we've just had a run of 5 European Court of Human Rights decisions in Strasbourg upholding aspects of UK counter-terrorism law. That's a sign to me that although the laws are tough, they're not far from being in the right place. Where I think we're not quite on the sweet spot is in this whole business of countering extremism. I mean, you mentioned the PREVENT programme. The government also proposed last year a countering extremism bill, which would enable extremist banning orders to be taken out against people who speak out against British values such as diversity and tolerance. I see a big flashing red light when I hear about ideas like that. I think it's extremely difficult to decide what is and is not extremism, and you very soon become perceived as somebody who's trying to regulate normal religious belief, normal discourse, and that I think is dangerous and counterproductive. So we haven't yet seen that bill, perhaps we never will, but I think that's an area that needs really careful watching, and I'm very glad that our judges are there, and beyond them the European judges, to make sure that if people's liberties are intruded on in this way, it doesn't go too far.
Are there any other particular challenges that you see in terms of trying to balance accountability mechanisms with concerns over security and civil liberties in the UK and further afield?
The other big issue, I suppose, in the UK is where the European supervision mechanisms fit into all this. I think we've been a big contributor to the Council of Europe system, to the European Court of Human Rights. We've provided great judges there. We've provided very interesting cases that have driven the case law along. And if our future in that organisation is now in doubt, in a way it's because of the success of our own Human Rights Act. We patriated the European Convention. We gave our own judges the power to apply it directly in our own courts. And of course, our own judges are very familiar with conditions in these islands. And once you get to that stage, people start asking, well, why is it exactly that we need these learned judges from Russia, Turkey, Moldova, France, wherever, to tell us where we've gone wrong and where we're going right? That, I think, is a political issue. It's one that lawyers have a duty to address because nobody else will. Mm. And it seems to me that the way you justify that is, yes, because they provide a bit of objectivity that perhaps even our own excellent judges don't always have, but more to the point, it's a way for us to contribute to a European rule of law, which can apply right across the continent to 800 million people. And that, I think, is really important.